I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Catherine Dargan, the head of M&A and corporate at Covington & Burling. Catherine, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, David. I'm very happy to talk with you.
So we're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, a little bit about your background and how you've gone about building your practice. Secondly, a range of issues in healthcare deal making, including regulation, antitrust, and the need for these businesses to return to their focuses as the era of COVID persists, issues around diversity and retention at law firms, and finally, a little bit about what you do in your downtime. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to practice M&A and practice at Covington.
Sure. Well, I grew up largely in South Carolina, where my dad is from, and I enjoyed growing up there. But by high school, I really wanted to leave the South. I just didn't think I'd have meaningful opportunities to explore different career options there at that time. And so I was and am a very curious, driven person. I decided to apply to college out in California because I had a second cousin who was at Stanford, and he sent me a brochure. And I had never heard of the school. These were the pre-internet days, and I loved what I saw. It was beautiful. And it turned out to be one of the best decisions I ever made. A low information decision, but with a great result. I met so many different people from all different backgrounds and parts of the country and the world. I studied abroad. I interned for a senator. I dabbled in politics and really developed close relationships with great professors, helping them with their research. So overall, I just had an amazing time. My parents worked in the medical field. They're long retired now, but thankfully still with us. And my dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, so I always thought I would go to medical school. But my battle with organic chemistry in college told a different story. So I refocused my efforts on going to law school. But I never really lost that fascination with medicine, and I'll come back to that because it's relevant to what I do today. At that time, when I was in college, I didn't know many lawyers at all, and certainly no corporate lawyers. What I saw on TV was very different than what I do today. And most of the shows were about prosecutors, other litigators, or those types of lawyers. And I really credit my focus on corporate law and law firm life generally on a program I applied to as a senior in college, Sponsors of Educational Opportunity, or SEO, that exposed me to life as a lawyer at a New York corporate law firm. And in my case, that was Davis Polk. I'd never experienced anything quite like that, but I was intrigued by the people, their dedication and focus and interaction with clients. And I was hooked. But I really wanted to live and work in the DC area where I had some extended families. So I asked my law school professors where to interview, and all of them flagged Covington. So that was my goal. And I was thrilled to secure a job here. Back then, it was an odd choice to do corporate law and M&A in particular in DC, but that's what I wanted to do. So with tremendous help from many others, I made it work. And over the next 25 years, plus marrying a saint and having three amazing kids, I focused my career on M&A deals of all stripes, public, private, joint ventures, cross-border, you name it, and doing deals in a bunch of different industries. At one point, I was a sports lawyer, but I'm not much of a sports fan. So that was probably wasted on me. I think my first hockey game ever was a Stanley Cup final. And I was sitting next to the NHL general counsel, who I loved working with. And all I could think of was others would really appreciate this experience more because they probably understood the game. So I moved on from sports. And in the past 15 years, I've spent a considerable amount of my time on life sciences deals. So while I will never discover the cure for cancer, I'm fortunate to work with terrific clients who will and who are true believers and totally dedicated to helping people. And I find it truly rewarding to play a very small role in bringing drugs and therapies and devices to market that can save lives or make people have a better quality of life. And my work isn't limited to life sciences. Of course, I've worked on deals in other industries, education, gaming, food, defense, all of those. But I think the one consistent factor has been amazing clients who trust me to give them the very best advice. And I'm grateful for that and certainly aim to deliver.
You mentioned that Covington, practicing being a corporate lawyer in DC, was a bit of an unusual choice in the 90s when you were coming out of law school. Talk about building your practice and especially your healthcare practice. Obviously, Covington has long had a very strong regulatory practice, which I'm assuming helped significantly.
It really does, David. And our roots were over 100 years as a regulatory firm growing up in the New Deal, helping clients navigate a regulatory environment. And in many ways, there's lots of really applicable parallels today where we're in a new age of intense regulation. And we have a broad food and drug regulatory practice and licensing and collaboration practice that we've had for years representing clients, pharmaceutical companies, biotechs, device firms, doing deals. And a lot of those companies have their own individual research arms, but they do a tremendous amount of M&A to grow out their product portfolios. And I thought that was a real opportunity based on what I thought we could offer that other law firms didn't offer, a more comprehensive look at deals from an operational perspective, from a regulatory perspective and the like. So we really focused on those clients. And I think being in DC, it was important to have something you're known for. And that was a big part of our growth strategy for the corporate practice at that time.
Talk to me a little just about how you pitch clients, how you go about building those relationships, because it sounds like it's something you enjoy and you're clearly good at. Was it something you walked in thinking that you were going to embrace or something that you kind of realized when you became a partner that you had to do?
It wasn't something that I thought I would be doing as when I first started at the firm as a young associate. I think client development, which we now think of as pitching clients, was something that a lot of law firms, including Covington, didn't really even think was seemly. And so this wasn't something that we really focused on. But I think at base, working with clients is about developing relationships. And I love that. I love understanding their business, what keeps them up at night, what their concerns are about getting their deals done. But it was born out of what do we have that's unique to offer to clients and how we can help them really develop their business. And from my perspective, our focus on life sciences was a natural one, but also where we felt like we could offer unique expertise, particularly in due diligence, where there are a lot of thorny issues on how you investigate whether a drug is likely to be approved, how you would take it to market, all of those types of issues. And I love M&A because it's like putting together a puzzle and thinking through all the issues. And you can't solve every issue in the deal, but there's certainly a lot that can be done to really execute the deals efficiently and effectively for our clients.
And talk about what you're seeing now in healthcare. Obviously, regulation is a huge piece of that, antitrust, other forms of regulation, and then the need that these businesses, like all entities, have to operate somewhat more normally than they've been doing over the last year and a half.
Right. And I would say, David, at the start of the pandemic, we, along with many others, thought M&A would dry up. But of course, the opposite happened. And given how broad and deep we are as a firm and as a practice in life sciences, we've really been in overdrive. Much of the last year was thrive with COVID-19 related deals, from acquisitions of companies with promising vaccine and therapeutic candidates to, we worked on a joint venture with a ventilator company and a car manufacturer to dramatically scale up the production and manufacture of ventilators. So all of that activity was really driven by clients' efforts to combat the COVID pandemic. But I'd say this year there was a noticeable shift, and the focus has been much more on traditional deal making, really centered on expanding product portfolios. And the real challenge this year, which has been historically a challenge, but I think in a more intense way, in advising clients in a very unpredictable regulatory environment. Many of our clients are used to navigating deals through highly regulated industries, but a few things have changed more recently, creating more uncertainty for a number of deals. So I'd say first, the regulatory environment, both here in the US and abroad, has been intense. So in cross-border deals, we've seen that. We've had, for example, CFIUS rules in place for quite some time here, but many foreign regulators either implemented new or bolstered existing foreign direct investment laws and regulations in the last 18 months. And these traditionally had been centered on national security concerns, but it appears to be much broader than that now in this new wave of legislation, including a real focus on tech and life sciences deals. And for cross-border deals or deals involving companies with overseas operations, this new analysis must be done. It's much like the multi-jurisdictional analysis that we always do in antitrust, but it has to be conducted early on in the deal to ensure that any necessary filings are identified and timing is factored into the overall deal timeline. But because many of these laws and regulations are new, particularly in Europe, in a number of jurisdictions, there's not much implementation history. So the filing analysis is really tricky, which introduces some level of uncertainty into the deal. I'd say another factor, of course, is antitrust. And really, that probably should be the first. We could do a full discussion just on antitrust. And your publication, The Deal, has reported extensively on the FTC and the challenges many deals are running into. And we know the FTC has been overburdened lately. And as a result, the outcomes have been less predictable. And again, this runs right to the core of deal timing, structure, and deal certainty. And now, when we're doing deals in Europe or involving European assets, we need to consider Article 22, which gives the European Commission the power to step in and assert jurisdiction in cases where that just didn't happen in the past. And we're also now regularly advising clients on strategies to manage that new risk. And so while antitrust has always been a focal point, that's even more the case now. We worked on a deal recently, and you're thinking about competing concerns around antitrust clearance and making sure you have enough time to do that. You're trying to get the deal done quickly. This was a multi-billion dollar public deal, but we also were thinking about shareholder activism, and we had to balance all of those considerations and thinking about how you structure the deal. So I say the third factor is also this enhanced scrutiny of deals, not just the shareholder derivative suits we've seen in the past, but shareholder activism and the prominence of proxy advisory firms and their views on merger transactions. And that can present deal risk too. And how you manage that risk starts very early in the discussions about a deal. So I'd say all these factors weigh into how we're advising clients now on how to structure deals, especially public deals. Do you do a one-step merger? Do you structure it as a two-step tender offer followed by a back-end merger? But also on private deals, do you file for HSR clearance on a term sheet to start the clock? And I think our role as counselor is to evaluate all these risks and factors and offer our very best advice on how to structure and execute the deal. It's exciting. And there's no cookie cutter answer. Each deal is different, but it's really central to what we're doing right now.
Catherine, you served 2 4-year terms on the management committee at Covington. How are you thinking about issues of diversity and also associate retention, given the pressures that COVID has placed on law firms?
Yeah, so I am strongly and passionately committed to diversity and inclusion issues, both in my leadership roles at Covington, as a deal lawyer, as a person, and of course, as a Black woman deal lawyer, I'm often an anomaly. And that results in sometimes being ignored, underestimated, even insulted in 25 years as an M&A lawyer, but you remain focused on getting the deal done for our clients. I do think life experiences as a diverse woman lawyer often give a unique perspective, and I think that's what we look for at the firm. And it can be really advantageous, I think, in doing the work that we do, and clients recognize that. We have been very focused in a variety of ways on increasing diversity at the firm. And throughout my time at Covington, I've seen through different lenses, serving on our evaluation committee, recruiting, the management committee, and as a practice group leader, that it's important to, one, set an example at the top that this is an important issue for the firm, and then to play an active role in driving diversity and inclusion efforts, particularly focusing on recruiting, retention, promotion. But I'd say in recent years, my focus has really been more on retention and promotion, because I think those are a lot harder. I think a lot of firms have figured out the recruiting piece of this, but are still struggling with how to create opportunities and an environment where excellent, diverse, and women lawyers can not just survive, but flourish and develop strong relationships with other lawyers and clients. And really providing those opportunities is key.
And how do you go about doing that? And what is the connection between retaining that set of lawyers and retention issues more broadly that all law firms are facing increasingly in an era of remote work?
There is a big tie, David, I would say, because I think a lot of our efforts to retain diverse and women lawyers really help to retain all lawyers. And we know during the pandemic, with the remote work, and even now where a lot of us are back in some sort of hybrid structure, there has been increased associate attrition. And I think a lot of that is about, I come back to relationships, and you want to have a comfortable environment, but you also want to have strong relationships between younger lawyers and more seasoned lawyers, lawyers who maybe don't look like you, or, you know, if you're an older lawyer, maybe someone who doesn't remind you of yourself 20 years ago. So
how about doing that? How do you encourage lawyers to kind of move outside of their comfort zone in whom they're mentoring?
Well, I think you have to be really intentional and deliberate about it. So some of it is formally building those relationships, assigning mentors and mentees. I also think we've had a lot of conversations as a firm, really open sort of town hall conversations where a lot of issues are aired that were bubbling beneath the surface, or questions that people could ask in a safe space, so that they really did become more educated or informed about how their colleagues were feeling and issues that are relevant. We've invested much more in our affinity groups, so that there are groups of lawyers with similar backgrounds who are able to share experiences. But I think a big part of this is being very, very strategic, having these discussions, having trainings, making them in many cases mandatory, so that when we're doing, for example, discussions about who you're going to promote from associate to counsel or partnership, and we have brought in professional people to train our folks about bias, unconscious bias, and to spot that and to try and manage that. But I think a big part of it is putting in place real tools so that lawyers can get better at this, and then encouraging them to reach out to lawyers. I think in this remote environment, David, it is harder because we aren't in one location and it can be very isolating, particularly for our newer lawyers who don't have the advantage of just sitting in a more senior lawyer's office and listening on a phone call or running into someone and asking a question that you wouldn't schedule a Zoom call to ask because you don't think it's big enough. So we're trying to find ways to connect people. I just think it requires more deliberateness than it did in the past and really, really focusing on creating those opportunities and providing support along the way so that people can succeed.
So you do see, it sounds like, real parallels between retention broadly in an era of remote work where a lot of people feel disconnected and retention of minority lawyers and lawyers who are women, you know, who feel isolated.
I do, because again, I think this is about relationships. I mean, I have been able to develop the career that I have because people invested in me. And a lot of those people had nothing in common with me. We didn't share similar background. We had really different lives, but they took an interest in me. I did, I hope, really terrific work for them. And we developed those relationships. I just think it's harder in a remote environment, but it's something that is necessary. I'm not sure we're ever going to go back to 5 days a week in the office and all of that. And I don't know that that's a good thing anyway. But I do think we have to be flexible and we have to adapt to these changing circumstances. And a lot of the tools that I think are important for associates generally are particularly important for diverse and women lawyers, just to make sure that people really do have those opportunities and really do have the mentorship and support that just allow them to be able to do what they really can do and succeed in this profession.
And then finally, tell us a little bit about how you stay sane as a lawyer, how you decompress.
So I spend virtually every spare moment I can with my family. That's my own immediate family, my husband and our kids, but also my parents who moved in with us last year. My mom had a stroke. And so now we're a sandwich family with multiple generations all under one roof. And we also have a very large extended family. And during the pandemic, we started an every other week, what we call an awesome global family Zoom meeting of family members. And I have family in Copenhagen, in Switzerland, in Tokyo, and all across the US. So my family is pretty spread out. And I don't think I was the only member of the family with wanderlust growing up. But I do think it has allowed us to grow a lot closer through regular calls than we ever would have without the pandemic. And it's fascinating learning about their lives, celebrating minor and major joys and all of that. With our kids, we do try and keep them grounded. So you know, my view is they're very fortunate to be able to grow up in a great environment, but my husband and I have always wanted them to understand the value of hard work. So one of the things we do as a family is we do community service projects together. For example, we volunteer a lot at our local food bank, packing meals and handing them out to people who don't have as much. And I think that's really important for them to remind, you know, it's a little bit of a grounding thing. So they understand more about what's really important. And it's also a really great way to convince teenagers to still hang out with their mom and dad. So that's my secret weapon.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.